We have two things on the agenda today. One is a public hearing on Senate Bill 519. That's school funding formula. We'll get the overview, and Ozzie Rose can give us all of the bloody details of how this bill got to us in its prime form. But first, we have an informational meeting and release of the anticipated report, economic and actuarial analysis of financial incentives in Oregon's workers' compensation insurance market. Okay? Mm-hmm. Paul, why don't you... Oh, and let me say, Jennifer will distribute one copy per person to anybody who wants it. Please just line up. And I'll mention for the record, if anybody's listening and not here in the room, copies of the report can also be picked up in the Legislative Revenue Office, H-197.
Actually, Chairman.
Yes.
I will be leaving my copy here. I would like to pick up my copy.
Well, and that's my next point. Members, please be sure to bring your copy of the report to future meetings regarding the issue. The next scheduled meeting for this committee is a week from today, May 9. The reason that will be important is that we do not have extra copies of this, and obviously we don't want to be making a bunch. So,
actually, you've got one extra copy right here.
I'm ready to vote. All right. Paul, if you would kind of give us an update of where we are on this then.
Mr. Chair, and those of you that are on the interim House Revenue Committee may recall that we did devote the majority of a full-day meeting looking at trends within the workers' comp insurance market. We heard quite a bit of testimony on from private insurers and also from the SAFE Corporation, from a national expert on other states. And as a result of that, there was a research report prepared summarizing the testimony. And following that, the Senate President, now the Senate President, Senator Durfler, requested that the committee go a step further and contract out for a study to look at the competitive forces within the state's workers' comp insurance industry. And so the Secretary of State's Audits Division was given the responsibility of managing the contract. The funding actually came from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. There was an RFP developed that was scored by a number of legislators, including yourself, Mr. Chair, as you recall. Mm-hmm. Contractors were selected, with the lead being Technical Economic Associates and Mercer and Associates. And this is the report. Their deadline was May the 1st, and we got the report late yesterday afternoon. So it looks like they've done a fair amount of work. There is a main text there. The other two thick volumes are the appendix. There's a lot of data involved in analyzing this industry, and so that's provided there. And we have asked them to be as detailed as possible in terms of documenting the work they've done. So that's the reason for the thickness of the volumes, and hopefully that will satisfy those that are looking at that issue in terms of how they arrived at their conclusions. I talked with Mike Ilio, the lead researcher, this morning, and we've made arrangements, and he said he would call back and confirm later this afternoon, but we think it should work for them to be here and testify before the committee on their findings next Wednesday, May the 9th. Then after this, they will go and give basically the same report to the Senate Business and Labor Committee. So that was a part of their contract, was to present and answer questions before legislative committees.
Okay. Do you want to address the members any discussion at all on the executive summary, or wait until we get into that?
I would rather not, Mr. Chair, and let the contractors discuss the issues. Keep in mind that we did not, as part of the RFP, we did not charge the contractors with making firm policy recommendations based on their findings. They're only to look at the industry under alternative scenarios and give us a sense of where they think the competitive pressures are moving the industry. So it's really a step one in terms of a fact-finding, an objective analysis of what are the forces at work within the industry. So that's That's what we ask for, and I'm not in a position to say whether we feel like we've gotten everything we asked for or not yet. I have tracked very closely and met with them a number of times, and they seem to be on track in terms of following that update.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions by committee members? We will take this up weekly today with the group that did the report. All right, then in the meantime, we'll have a chance for everybody to digest the report and the summaries. I would encourage members at least to have some familiarity with the Volume 1. I think that would be best to be conversant with that. I'm not sure how relevant the tables will be to us for our discussion next week, but I would encourage members to spend some time looking at Volume 1 at least, to be reading the text of the report. This was a big issue in the interim, and of course it has continued to have be an item for discussion through the interim, through this current session. Now we've got some...
Mr. Chair,
would
it be appropriate to assign Representative Kefouri to sort of read it all and then report back to you?
A book report.
Yeah.
A book report.
That would be a good idea.
You know, but you'd probably just read the executive summary.
I think Alex would enjoy reading it.
Okay. With that then, thank you, Paul. Let's go into a public hearing on the bill that we've been waiting for since the... Paul of the gavel to open this session. Glad to see and mark its arrival in our committee today. Senate Bill 519. Steve, you want to come on up? I'll open a public hearing on that. Oh, you can do it from down there. That's fine.
Mr. Chair, initially I was asked to kind of refresh your memory about this,
sure,
the school formula,
yeah,
and how that operates, so that I would be up to speed for dealing with the school finance bills. You have a packet of information in front of you that starts with 519. At the back, I think it's the last page or two, if you can find a sheet that looks a bit like this. It's my cheat sheet or trick sheet on the formula, and we can just take a quick look through that to refresh your memories. Actually, there's... last sheet, I think, might be a graph, too, that we'll get to on small high schools, and try to mention a few of the things that are coming up in terms of legislation, either on the Senate side or the House side, and then talk about 519 at the end. If you recall from the orientation session in January, there was a whole host of slides that we worked through about the formula and other aspects of funding. If you want to go back to that full slideshow, it's available out on the website, the Legislative Revenue Office webpage. It is available. If you look at the top of the page, you can see the formula in its simplistic form, basically being formula operating revenue equals the sum of three different grants: the general purpose grant, transportation grant, and facility grant. The formula operating revenue, the formula is included there in terms of operating revenue because not all operating revenue is included in this process. So any federal dollars or other sources of revenue that are not included in the formula can be used for operations but aren't part of this process. And it's operating in the sense that there's no bond revenue dollars included here. But if you look under the bars, you can see a little bit more of the detail. The operating revenue consists of the state school fund grant and any local revenue for the school district. You recall that split is about 70% state school fund and 30% local revenue. The other thing I guess to note here is that the state school fund doesn't all go to the formula. Some of it goes for ESD, some of it goes for funding YCEP, the Youth Corrections Education Program. A small portion goes to help pay for the out-of-state costs for some high disability students that receive their services out of state. But by and large, most of it does end up being allocated by this formula. What I would like to do then is, I think, go over and start on the right-hand part of that and talk about the facility grant for just a few minutes and work back that way, trying to start with the simple and end up with a little bit of the more complicated. Well, let's first, before doing that, let's go and just look at the list of local revenue. If you go down on the right-hand column, about halfway down the page, you'll see local revenue highlighted and a list of all of the sources that are included in local revenue. A couple things to point out here. One is that the property taxes are property taxes collected, not what's imposed, so that it includes both property taxes collected for the current year and any collections on unpaid prior year taxes, a combination of that. And even if the imposed taxes goes up, that doesn't necessarily mean the collected taxes will go up the same percentage, because you don't know what percent, you have to estimate what percent of current year taxes will be paid versus how much of prior year taxes will be collected. The other thing to note here, I think, is that even though the federal timber harvest payments are included as a separate line, they flow through the county school fund and get distributed in that manner. The other is to note that the Grant and Wallawa Equalization Funds are shared with local districts. That will come up when you discuss ESDs and equalizing ESDs once the Senate bill arrives here, gets here, and how that might be handled in that bill. But basically, if they levy property taxes for their local school districts at the ESD level, they share it with their school districts, and then that shared dollar is counted as local revenue in the K-12 equalization formula. That's about all I really need to say about local revenue, except perhaps that to refresh your memory about what it doesn't include. So any gifts, grants, endowments are excluded, virtually all voluntary sources, interest, property sales, insurance payments, those kinds of things. Sources of operating revenue for the district, but not included in the formula. Any questions on local revenue?
Steve, do you want to get into talking about the federal forest, I guess the payments in lieu of, or do you want to wait to get that there later?
I think we better wait till we get
that's fine.
Get a bill to work with. Okay, then if we go up to the facility grant, it says up there up to 8% of construction costs, and there's just a little blurb there on under facility grant, again in the right-hand column about midway down the page. A couple of things to keep in mind about the facility grant. It says up to, because the funding is limited to $17.5 million per biennium. That's all that can be distributed for a facility grant. And if the construction costs are sufficiently high that 8% of those construction costs exceed the $17.5 million over a biennium, then they get prorated down. The intent last session was to try to fund about 8%, but the costs were reported to us were too low, so that when we started getting more accurate numbers, the 8% or the $17.5 million wasn't sufficient to fund at 8%. For this biennium, the funding level will probably be closer to 5.4% or thereabouts rather than 8. And without any increase in that $17.5 million cap, it's going to probably be even a lower percentage in the old 103 biennium.
Yes, Representative Hess.
Say we wanted to raise that to $100 million. Do you have a sliding scale on what percentage that would be in terms of?
Not handy, no.
Okay.
Ozzie? Okay, we'll wait.
Well, Mr. Hess, just wondering how many requests grants were made, how many requests were made in this fund.
I didn't count them. There's probably less than half the school districts. But there's some concentrated expenditures for a few school districts. Okay. The other thing I'm supposed to note is that, again, the dollars aren't to be spent for construction costs. They're basically for furnishings and equipment that you put into the new building that's funded with bonds or another source. And it covers new construction, whether it's new classrooms or whether it's additions to existing buildings or portable classrooms. I'll be included in those costs. The next grant is the facility grant, transportation grant. That's very straightforward. Under the transportation grant in the text, again, you have a list of the kinds of transportation that are considered approved transportation costs and that are available for 70% reimbursement. Basically, it's for transporting students to and to school, from home and back again, depending on if they live far enough away. And then for school field trips and activities that require moving from one school building to another. There is a bill this session on the Senate side that would expand the definition of transportation costs to include costs for school-sponsored activities beyond field trips. If it was a sports event or whatever, team travel, that would be included. There's a House bill that would do that too, mm-hmm. as well as a Senate bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Carlson.
My understanding of that bill is not just for team sports, but it's for after-school activities.
School-sponsored after-school activities.
Right.
That's when we did the tap-tap on Friday and didn't have the hearing on Monday. Yeah.
Right.
It'll be up on Friday.
Thank you.
So that would expand the cost that could be included and, of course, the transportation grant at 70% of those added costs. Okay, then the general purpose grant is by and far the largest component of the three. It takes about 96% of the total funds available go out through the general purpose grant. The transportation grant is about 3.5%, and the facility grant is about 0.3%. So you can see the relative magnitude of each of those grants and which is the more important. The general purpose grant is driven primarily by numbers of students after waiting. If you look at the list on the left-hand column under student weights, you can see all of the weights there listed. I don't want to talk about all of them. Kindergarten, though, is still at 1/2. There's been proposals to increase that to 1, but currently it's at 1/2. The elementary and union high districts only apply to those in Harney County, so they're almost phased out, not used anymore. We'll come to the remote small high school a little bit later. That varies depending on the size of the classes and the remoteness of the school. And then you have the whole list of special education and at-risk weights. I suppose the thing to note here is that the individual education program, of course, has that 11% gap in terms of the number of students that can be counted there unless the school district requests or goes through the waiver process to ask the Department of Education to increase or approve special education students above that 11% cap. The weight is an extra of 1, and each student then would count as 2 weighted students. The other thing to note here, I think, is that some of these weights are individual in terms of the weight being attached to a student, identified with a student, and some are group weights. The individual education program in English as a second language weights are attached to the student. You identify the student and have that weight with the student. If you look at some of the others, the students in poverty, for example, that's based upon census data. And so there's a group, a number for the school district based upon that census information and being updated from year to year and not identified with the individual student. Pregnant and parenting is that way, neglected and delinquent and students in foster care are both group numbers as well. You'll see in one of the bills, or we'll put it, I would suggest to be put in a bill to update the census date to the 2000 census. Currently in the statute, it's
only references the 1990 census. That will be a technical correction that will be coming to take care of that update. And then in that process, you also have to update the year for that census for calculating changes to the census data into the future, or that time your window before the next census would be available. Any questions about the weights themselves? I don't know of any, I can't think of any bills offhand that deal directly with the weights, although I'm sure there are some. The Senate hasn't currently dealt with any that would change these weights. What
Representative Carlson?
And I just wanted to clarify, there's nothing in statute or in the rules that say that the monies have to be spent on the populations that create the weights. Is that?
That's correct.
This is a funding formula. It's not an allocation formula with respect to the districts.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Bates?
Mr. Chair, just for my edification, I believe I heard you say that some of these categories are determined on the basis of statistics, not individual students, which I understand. And you mentioned the 1990 census, and I want to make sure I'm clear on this. My previous understanding was when you looked at, students in poverty, we would look at the number of kids that are on a free and reduced lunch program as a result of their impoverishment, and that would be the number we turned into the state. Maybe I misunderstood that. Is it, in fact, based on 1990 census for the area the district is serving?
Mr. Chair, Representative Page, there's student counts for families that are in poverty. So you take the census definition of families in poverty, and then you have a count for the students in those families. And that data is used then for most school districts. There is an option for some of the small counties to use the student lunch count program because the census data is based upon samples, and it's felt that the samples for the small counties aren't adequate to be a good count.
Well, Mr. Chair, so a lot of the weighting in these programs are based on the 1990 census.
No, only the poverty is based upon the census data.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the biggest factors involved in some of the schools we're dealing with. So that information, though, is based on 1990.
Yes, it is.
So for determining students in poverty, it's based on that census, not on, except for the exception of the small counties.
It's based upon that census, and it's also updated each year based upon growth in students in the district. So if you have a growth in students, that growth is applied to the 1990 poverty count census data to bring it up.
But on a formula based on the 1990 census.
Yes, that's the base, yes.
Yeah.
So the assumption is that, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. assumption is that ratio of students in that district, as far as poverty is concerned, has not changed significantly over the last 10 years.
Relative to their students, yes.
Thank you.
How many counties use the lunch count?
Well, I don't know offhand. I'm trying to remember what the county, I think there's a county size, something in the statute that defines which ones are eligible, and offhand I don't recall what that is.
Chair, that's something that may be worth looking at. I'm a little surprised by that figure. A 10-year period of time can have a huge change in the county as far as what's happening, poverty or lack of poverty. If you happen to do it in 1989 in Coos County and did it again and 10 years later, 1990, it was a dramatic change during that time. And I'm just using that as an example.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, some would argue that the adjustment perhaps is the wrong way, that if you have student growth, that might indicate fairly good economic conditions and less poverty. And if you have student decline, that you may have more poverty students. So,
Mr. Chair, I could easily argue the opposite in that in my particular district, it's just the opposite. We have only low-income housing in the valley, so when people move into that low-income housing, we're having more and more people in poverty come in, and we're expanding low-income housing in that district. And so I would think that the opposite would hold true for that particular district. if it's something that may want to be looked at, there's another way of tweaking that formula, and maybe the free and reduced lunch program is the way to go.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, one of the reasons that free and reduced lunch wasn't used statewide is that it's a voluntary program in terms of having to sign up for it. And it's thought that a lot of the students don't sign up for it because of the potential stigma attached.
I understand that, but I would say that social stigma is probably equal across the state. You still get a good ratio.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
How do we look at these weights and try to gauge whether these are the appropriate level? And maybe there's a political element of that which you can't answer. But, you know, I look at English as a second language, and you've got a 50, at one half weight, I'm at 50%. How do we know that that's not too high or too low? And same with these others. How do we gauge that? Where these were pretty much created in 1991. They haven't been changed in 10 years. State has gone through or completed a recession and gone through a record economic boom. World, it's a different world. We've equalized our school districts. Poverty shifted around. I know it's a can of worms, but I think I knew this committee. I just want to ask a question and to you and probably to the chair as well.
Just to sort of respond after
Steve. Yeah, maybe you have thoughts too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, yes, they were set in 1991. They were based upon primarily upon what national studies were known at the time and professional judgment of people, educators that work in these various programs. And I would probably add that what was politically feasible at the time as well. There hasn't been much work done since then in terms of trying to evaluate whether they're reasonable or not, primarily because there wasn't good information about the spending in each of these programs. Now with the data cleansing process that's been started a few years ago, we're just about to the point now where I think there'll be good data to evaluate what those weights should be and whether it would be recommended to change them based on that information.
Representative Williams?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to comment to Representative Beck that I think the word to describe this issue is detente. I think
your political answer.
I think your point is one that's valid, but you start nudging towards that formula in reopening that discussion on a Broadway, and there doesn't seem to be very many people who want to do that.
Is there an efficient way to model changes? Like if someone were to show up and say, here, we know a lot more about English as a second language, and we know that when you have kids in your school that for which that is a circumstance, it costs a lot more to educate that kid and all the other kids in that school. If we had data that told us that, and we concluded that, well, this 50 or one half weight is not sufficient, and we were to change that to 0.75, do we have a quick way of modeling what that would mean to the whole, or is that a complicated process?
Well, Steve, I guess we have a way to model in the sense of outcome. If you look at what would that do to the distribution statewide, just as I don't know, how many simulations did we get up to last session on the... We got up to 57 simulations, which shows that there were that many considered changes in the formula that would have a different outcome in the distribution of monies. And I think, you know, my experience, having been through this exercise twice, is what you see is that discrete changes make things different, but it's hard to tell when you look at it in gross whether you've made it better. Right. And... I think, getting back to your original question, I think that having achieved
a political agreement in 91 on the formula. What the formula really has become now is a means of just a settled means of distributing money. And partly, you know, your question, do we know, does it cost more to educate or less a kid with ESL or special ed? Maybe or maybe not, but I, since the districts aren't required to spend the money in the areas that relate to the criteria in the formula, it almost...
Interesting.
Yeah, and it almost doesn't matter.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, you said a politically settled. I mean, I don't think it really is, because it does seem, regardless, we do a little tweaking every session, whether it's the small school adjustment or you know, some other tweaking. Yeah. I mean, there's always...
It's a case model.
Let me just say substantially settled, I guess. We
maybe that's a better way.
Major reform of the formula.
Representative Bates, I think, has
it. Oh, sure.
Just, I'll just make a few comments, which I'm not sure it'll help, but I'll make a few comments from what experience I've had. You've asked the key question, Representative Beck. I mean, is this a model that is functional and represents reality? I would suggest it's probably more art than science. I spent 10 years on a school board, and during that time I was chronically reading at least once a week articles and studies saying, if you put this much money in, what do you get out the other end? And it was really difficult to determine what educational outcomes you would get from various amounts of money put into the system. You can go to areas like Kansas City, where they poured a huge amount of money into their inner cities, and they got absolutely nothing out of it as far as change is concerned. And you go to areas like Kentucky, which had underfunded their programs, restructured, refunded, and they had outstanding changes. So they're all over the map. I think what I finally resolved my own mind after 10 years of playing with this was to sit back and say, what kind of educational system in general do we have in Oregon? How do we do in our SAT scores compared to other states? How do we do as far as socioeconomic factors are concerned? And the bottom line for Oregon schools is we do pretty doggone good. We do real well compared to the amount of money we put in. And we're one of the lowest funded in the country, and yet we have I think we're number two in SATs or something like that. And that's not a bogus number. That's a number that shows we test a large number of kids right down through not just the top 10%. So those kind of things are reassuring to me and indicate that we're probably roughly in the right area. Should it be tweaked from time to time? I agree that it should be. We need to keep looking at it. But until we have solid outcomes that we can look at from studies, I'm not sure that's wise to try to start changing at this point. But we should keep asking that question.
Okay.
The student count is an extended student count, and you'll remember that that means that it's the weighted students of the current year compared to the prior year, and taking the higher of the two. There are several bills that have been looked at to change the definition of extended so that primarily they help school districts that have had declining weighted student counts. To go back more than 1 year, to go back three or four, or however how many years the bill might propose. So far, that hasn't. I don't think none of those have made it to the floor. I don't think they've made it out of committee yet either. That would change the definition of extended. The other portion of the general purpose grant, then, is the $4,500 target amount. That hasn't been changed since 1991. It was set arbitrarily as something to work up to. The funding level is now such that we're above it. And that $4,500 is adjusted by a teacher experience factor. You may recall from hearing before that if the district average teacher experience is above the state average, then that adds dollars to that $4,500. If the district average is below the state average, it takes dollars away from that average. And it's $25 per year difference from the state average, whether it goes up or down. Once you have that teacher experience adjustment to the $4,500, then there is this ratio or percentage that's applied to balance the funds available to what the formula says can be distributed. Right now, that balancing factor is about 107% or 1.07. When you first started out with the 4,500 back in 91, it was maybe 94% or 93%, something like that. And over time, that percentage has gone up as the funding has increased. If you, for example, wanted that balance ratio not to be 107%, but 100% again, then what could be done is to increase the $4,500 to about $4,800 or $4,900, something like that. And your balance ratio would go down to 1, and you would start from there again as funding increased. The other point, I suppose, here is to just mention, as mentioned the obvious, I suppose, is that as long as the state school fund and local revenue dollars are at some fixed amount, then any changes to these grants shift money among the grants. Okay. And the balancing factor then is the ratio that balances funds available to funds to be allocated by the formula. The one other thing I want to touch bases on is the most small school, which you have dealing with small high schools. If you'll look at the chart, I think it's the last page in the packet, just to take a look at that, talking about small high schools and whether they are remote or not. The small high schools have to be in school districts that have less than 8,500 students, and the high school itself has to be under 350 if it's a four-grade high school, and 267, I think it is, if it's a three-grade high school. But if it's in a small district, and if it's a small high school, and if it's distance requirements over 10 miles to the nearest high school, then it can qualify from some additional weights for being a small high school. The top graph just gives you an idea of the weight that's applied at each size of high school based upon its ADM. So it's somewhat less than 1, which means that the weight can't add more than 100% to the number of students. If you look at the bottom chart then, which is probably more meaningful, the calculation is done on a minimum of 60 students, so you can see that the distance between the diagonal line and the curved line is fixed under that at about 50 additional students. So you can have a high school of 20 students, you would get an additional weight of 50 for a total of 70, and so on. The weighted ADM, as you can see, has to taper off once you get to the 350 limit for your high school, so you don't have a cliff effect in that process. At 200 ADM, that size high school, the extra weight is about 87 students. So you would have 287 weighted students associated with that small high school. And this assumes that the high school is at least 20 miles away. That means it's fully remote. If it's between 10 and 20 miles, it's a partially remote high school. And there's a distance adjustment factor that comes into play. If it were at 15 miles, then the weighted students between the diagonal line and the curved line would be cut in half. You'd only get 50% of those students. Last session, though, the legislation was passed that would add back or reduce the impact of that distance factor, the reduction from the distance factor. And for the 0103, it only applies at a 50% rate. And then it goes up to 75, and then finally the distance adjustment factor is done away with. So it's being phased out, but it also helped small high schools that were under 10 miles, weren't remote at all. So they're being phased in as small high schools without having any reduction or not being very far away from another high school. Okay, so that's basically the elementary small school factor works in the same way, only the distances and the weights are different. Any questions about that?
Okay, you're done.
All right. That covers, I think, pretty much everything on the summary sheet. And if there aren't any questions then about the formula, we can talk about the bill. Senate Bill 519 has a referral to Ways and Means after you complete it. It creates a small school supplement fund, and it transfers $4.5 million per year from the state school fund to the school district supplement fund. And the fund then can be used for small high schools or allocated based upon small high school students. They have to be, again, in a district that has less than 8,500 weighted students, and the high schools have to be less than 350 students, or the 367 students if it's a three-grade high school. What it does is to take this pool of $4.5 million a year and say each ADM of that small high school gets $200 in additional funds. That's expected to use up about $3 million of the $4.5 million each year. Then the other $1.5 million can be used to make specific need grants to small high schools based upon an application process and criteria. And if the grants don't use up that $1.5 million, then it would go back and be allocated as an addition to the $200 grant, so that all of the funds would be used up in that process. It also requires that there be a study of the relationship between small school size, cost, and program needs. And then it also allocates $150,000 of state school fund money to do a study of special education funding and services, both at ESD and K-12 Department of Ed levels. And then it requires reports to be made based on those studies. The small school supplement fund and the legislation dealing with it sunsets in June 30, 2003, so it's only a two-year program. Then also in 519 is the technical correction to update the census year 2000.
That was the question you referred to earlier?
Yes, it is. Okay, and then you have a printout of the impact by school district of the $200 for ADM for the small high schools. There isn't any distribution of the remainder $1.5 million because that's on a grant application basis, and I didn't really have a way of allocating those funds by district. And with that, I think I'm finished.
Okay. Well, Joan, who do we have signed up? Nobody else? Ozzie, do you want to come forward?
And ask it.
Representative Bates, yeah.
Questions?
Come on up.
Quality education model. Is that in this? $200 million for quality education model, is that included in this budget? It is not.
That's a separate appropriation?
Yes. That's what, $200
million? Is that what the governor requested? I think so. $220? Come on up, Buzz.
School improvement fund.
Yes, sir.
School improvement fund, I'm sorry, wrong phrase.
That's not data.
Okay. That's not what?
That's not related to data.
Now, has there been a discussion how that money is going to be distributed, and that's going to come as a second bill, a different bill?
Mr. Chair, excuse me, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rolls, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And I'm here because of 519, but maybe to talk about the formula a little bit.
Sure.
Senate Bill 519 came from the superintendent's group, the way you're getting it, and so I feel compelled to share a little bit of history with you and how we got here.
Can we answer Representative Bates' question first? $220 million, is that in Ways and Means?
The appropriation is in Ways and Means as part of the budget.
Right.
There is a bill in education that lays out the connection between the process of applying for it and that kind of stuff, what needs to be in it. 20, $22.98, I think, is that bill.
Would it be coming through this committee or straight to Ways and Means?
I'd probably go straight to Ways and Means.
I think it goes straight to Ways and Means.
Not part of the formula.
Correct.
Jumping off the track, last question.
Mm-hmm.
There's a note here on page 8, Portland PERS bond desegregation costs excluded. Would you explain the Portland PERS bond to me real quickly?
The Portland, before they were in PERS, they were had their own retirement system. Excuse me, for the record, it's Ozzy again.
And
they were required to, in the early 80s, to go into the PERS, and their old program was not funded actuarially. It was funded the other way they do that. And so they had to come up with an amount of money to buy into the system for all their unfunded liability, and that was negotiated between PERS and Portland and legislature. And then they sold a bond to pay for that, and I think the bonds paid off within the next couple, 3 years. And the theory behind the formula, and some people agree with this, some won't, by the way, but the theory of why it's there, is that the formula distributes money. If we all had exactly the same burden, you wouldn't need a weighted formula. You just divide it by the number of kids and send the money. The theory behind the formula is that different districts have different proportions of the burden, and the PERS burden for Portland is one that they're the only one that has that burden. So it was set aside, and they can buy that out of it without you counting as local money. That's the theory behind it. Nobody else has an unfunded liability to pay off. Everybody was in the PERS system. Portland was forced again to go into it, and as a part of that, they had this unfunded liability. That's a burden only they bear, so it doesn't count.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How much is that? How much is the annual payment on that bond?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't. Maybe he does.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, it's about $13 million a year.
And that's paid for out of general fund money?
Well, it's paid for out of their money, but they don't count it as local revenue. So you know how the formula works? They run the formula and they say this school district should have this much money, and you've got so much of it's local, we'll fill in the pot. In Portland's case, they have the bond that they're paying, and they don't count that as local money. If they counted it, then that would reduce the amount by $13 million that they would get. And in that sense, it's paid for out of general fund, but it's not counted as local revenue. And it's and the same thing with the DSEG money, there's $6 or $7 million.
About seven.
And quite a number of years ago in the DSEG arguments and court orders, et cetera, they did some things with busing and created some programs to avoid problems in desegregation. And at the time the form was put together, that was deemed a burden nobody else had. Again, not everybody agrees with all this, but that's the theory, okay? Is that fair, Senator or Representative Kevorey? Senator Kevorey was here when we did that.
I can readily understand the desegregation problem. I do not accept or understand the other problem. That's a burden that school district should have taken on itself for not doing what it should have done in 1980. But that's water on the bridge now. It's one that clear. Thank you.
Ozzy, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Ozzy Rose, We got into this in 1991. The fund was developed as a result of moving to a state-funded system. The form was put together partly politically, partly pragmatically, and partly scientifically. There have been a number of proposals to change it over the years. We actually only fully implement it now. We phased in the equity concept because you had high and you had low, and you phase it in. And if you were high, we phase it in too fast. If you were low, we didn't phase it in fast enough. Everybody is on the formula where they belong now. And this is the first session in which that's the case. And I testified a lot of times through the 90s saying when we finally get there, everybody have ideas how to fix it. Because the only way you can get more money is to fix the formula. And then you have 20 bills, I believe, to fix the formula this session. And most of those bills fix the formula from some perspective. Usually it's pretty narrow, and when there's winners and losers. And this was complicated this session in that there's a fixed amount of money. Every session prior to this one, and like when you talked about we ran 57 runs last time, every run had more money in it. And so the tweak was different and there was more money in it and so forth. This time, every run you do rearranges the money because it all starts from the 5.2 assumption. And that makes the runs more interesting to look at. We, in the 91 session, had districts who were better off and worse off, and we argued over and built the formula, and we put the constraint on the formula. And between the 91 and 93 session, our group said, we got to figure out a way to try to work out our differences first and then go to the legislature to avoid the battle between school districts in front of the legislature. And we formed a group called the Oregon School Funding Coalition. And we created it by not by people, but by looking at the different characteristics of districts. We had at that time rich and poor ones, property rich, property poor. We had rural, urban, obviously, and we called urban non-metro, meaning the larger cities out away from the metro area, the Pendletons and so forth. And then we had county, and we had size. And so we took wealth, size, and type of district, built a matrix, and tried to develop a sample so all those areas were represented. And our first committee had 24 superintendents on it. That group is now 41 people and has existed and worked on these issues. And I presented each session the position of the school districts as a group. Now, there's been some change on that group. People have retired and so forth, and the replacement is that district. You stay on that by the characteristics of the district. There have still been some lobbyists for certain districts arguing their case, but by and large, the school people have had a program that they've put forth and worked on the formula. This last year, that group decided to take on, should we change the formula? And the first time I gave them data, I provided them probably enough paper to clear cut probably a quarter of an acre of ground, all different colors, and I took all the different things you might do. You can do anything you want now with the computer. And they argued and discussed, and by and large, every change changes who gets money. And you look at it, if you look at the column at the end, my dollars per student, one idea is good, one idea is bad, but when you look at all of them, the formula kind of holds together. And it's not an entitlement formula. It's a distribution formula. It was never meant to be an entitlement formula. There is some science behind each of the numbers. The poverty number you've discussed, and whether you like it or not, the effort in all of them was to develop a set of numbers that couldn't be manipulated by local school districts. You may find that difficult to believe, but there are folks who would manipulate the numbers if it became to their advantage to do so.
Which one of those is we're not supposed to, we're not hard to believe?
Yeah, right. At the time when we did this, for instance, the special ed thing, nationwide, 2.0 was the average, about twice the cost. And so that's why we came up with that particular thing. The problem with averages is in a large N, the average works. Smaller the N, the more likely the average number isn't working. And so you do have that difficulty when you do that. Florida at the time, their formula, they had 17 different categories of special ed, different weights, depending on the type of disability. We didn't call them disabilities then, but the type of problem, the special ed student, he had a different, or she had a different weight. And we tried to keep it as simple as possible so that the kids weren't categorized for formula reasons rather than for real reasons. And so that's what we've lived with over this period of time. And by and large, the formula is still intact. It has been tweaked a little bit, but not much. We entered this session with, like I say, after several meetings and a lot of looking at what are all the possibilities, with leave the formula alone, and we moved through that process, and then we got to session, and here are 19 or 20 bills. And the bills, you know, one of the problems is people look at their situation and say, change this, and that's a good idea. And the declining enrollment is one that's a very good example. That came from some small school, the original, actually the bill came out of funding out of South Dakota, but it was first posed by some folks in Eastern Oregon in small schools. Because everybody uses the term small declining school. Some small schools are declining, but most districts in Oregon are declining. And when you, so this declining enrollment, instead of having the 1 year phase done last year versus this year as the count to give you a 1 year's hedge, let's make it 4 years, go back to the last four or next year. It sounds like a good idea. I look at my own budget, and that's a good idea. But what I don't see when I do that is that that's going to apply to everybody. And in pure numbers, large districts are declining. And you go back and let Portland get their enrollment they had 5 years ago, and let Coos Bay get their enrollment they had 5 years ago, et cetera. And so then it doesn't look as good to some of the people who thought this was a good idea. And by and large, that's a problem with most of the discussions. People look at their situation and don't have the ability to look at what happens when you mix all of them. And then the next thing is let's do several of them at the same time and see what happens. And end of story, we work through all those things and said you ought to leave it alone. Then we come here and there's a lot of bills. And in the Senate side, we messed with it for 14 weeks, 13 weeks. And finally the chair said, and we had advocates for all these ideas. And the chair said, go sit down and try to come back with what you think ought to happen from the superintendent's group. And that led to 519. And the first, they asked me, how does our group take on these issues? And I said, the same way you do. The first hour of every meeting is each person talking about how tough it is in their particular situation. Or your, these constituents are the same ones that you have. And so we go through this the first hour of every meeting, explaining how tough it is with my declining enrollment or my special ed or whatever. And then we get out the computer runs and we do that. And at this last meeting in March, at the request of the Senate side, we looked at no changes, increasing support for small schools, increasing support for facilities fund, declining enrollment, special ed, the cap increase, and so forth. And after looking at all those and arguing about them, one of the superintendents said, we need to set the runs aside and try to talk about what really needs to be done in the short term. What can we and should we do? Not looking at just where the money gets moved around from our personal perspective. And after about 2 hours of discussion of that issue, special ed issue is a very important issue, and there are several places here in the legislature to do something about it. And this side, it was the cap. Take the 11% cap, move it to 13, and moved a lot of money around. But the bottom line was the special ed, all of the special ed bills, there's one on the declining enrollment, or excuse me, the cap, there's one on the workload of special ed teachers, another one on autism. And our position is that somebody needs to sit down and look at across the board. There's supposed to be new federal money, more federal money for federal ed or for special ed, and that we need a very good look at the special ed thing in total, and we ought to take some of the general fund, or excuse me, the school fund, help fund that, and that's why that particular thing is in this thing. The other issue that came out of this that they supported is that all schools are in difficulty, but most school districts are looking at net reduction in program of some type, even at the level of funding we're talking about. And it varies how much, but everybody is having difficulty balancing the budget and talking about the investments and stuff that we're trying to make. The budgets are running, the revenues are estimated up 3 to 3.5, 3.7% by and large, and their costs are up higher than that. And so they have a problem. Having said that, the issue of the very small schools trying to run high schools that can provide the courses and meet the CAM and the what we anticipate to be the CAM, but the SIM and so forth, is a very, very difficult problem. Growth is difficult, decline enrolls is a problem, but the issue with the small school isn't just that it's a problem funding, but can you actually have a viable, adequate program? And you get different points of view. Everybody has their situation. It's mostly anecdotal, but there is a general feeling that there needs to be some kind of a floor of a program. If we're going to have schools all over the state and small and large size, there's got to be, if we're going to have high standards, some minimum program available. And it probably costs more in some places than others to do that. And so that led to the effort to do something with just the small school thing, and we did it two ways. By the way, small in our state, the schools with that we're describing, the districts under 8,500, and that's not a small school district in our state by any means, but high schools are 350 or less. Half of our school districts are accounted for in that. Most of our school districts are small by many state standards. And so this proposal addresses some assistance to all high schools up to 350 kids. And we took two-thirds of the money, about $3 million of the $4.5 million, and distributed it to the high schools on a per-student basis for ADMR, not AMW, for ADMR, so that all get some assistance. And then we said, set aside the other third and create a grant program and justify the need, and we have some criteria for that need. And we also said, the State Department now has a database to start really focusing on what does it take and answer the question to run a school of this size, how much you absolutely have to have, and we have data that can be developed to build that case. And part of the bill contains a requirement that the department take that on as a task in the interim. So that was the logic. Why did you tweak this and not something else? Those the two things, special ed and how do you get a basic program in a high school of 50 kids, 70 kids, 100 kids, as opposed to the larger ones that have more flexibility. And hopefully when we come back here in 2 years, your successors, or you if you're still here, will have a better data set to analyze those questions and make decisions. One of our quarrels, your staff person said you'll deal with the federal forest issue in another bill, which I assume you will, but one of our problems is contrast what we try to do here. The federal forest issue was supposedly designed for small schools, small communities. But over half the money went to our 60 largest school districts. And it didn't go to some small school districts at all. Only 10% of it went to our 60 smallest school districts. And because it isn't connected with how we distribute the money. And one of our arguments in trying to give some assistance to all schools is that there are a lot of small schools. And the high school, we focus on that because that's where you have the difficulty with having both calculus and trigonometry or having physics and chemistry at the same time, et cetera, to meet the needs of those kids. I think I'll quit and answer questions if you have it. That's how we got to here. The bill doesn't do very much, and we're hopeful that you are able to support the bill as presented to you.
Questions for, yes, Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a legitimate problem, Ozzy, but I want to know and have your explanation why this is a bigger problem than the high growth problem in vain for construction in the high growth districts like Beaverton, Hillsborough, and Tigard.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Haas, I don't know that I'd describe it as a bigger problem. By the way, to your earlier question about the amount of money to fund 8% on the facilities grant that's there, it would take about $40 million to fund it in the next biennium. There's only $17.5 million to fund that. Having said that, the problem is the bigger problem with the facilities, trying to solve the facilities problem in our operation budget. There isn't enough money in operation budget to solve it. And moving $17 million or $10 million around doesn't, the facilities problem needs to be addressed. It's got to be addressed in a larger way than we can do through the operations side.
If I could just follow up, Mr. Chair. What would you think then of raising the facility grant to $100 million?
Mr. Chairman, the problem with that, that's $100 million out of operations going just to facilities. And $100 million out of operations, $50 million a year of the biennium. And $50 million is about 80 bucks a kid out of operations.
Statewide.
Statewide, yes. For every district. It takes 80 bucks a kid off everybody's operating budget. And our argument is that facilities are a problem. But they can't be solved in this operations budget.
The Mr. Chair, if I Dearborn School District has grown by a size that's bigger than some of these districts. Just last year, it's grown bigger than a lot of these districts that this bill would help just in this last year.
Yes.
Operations money just doesn't help. And if you can't buy the land, which is more expensive, I think this goes back to Representative Beck's original question. It begs the question that the population has increased in the state more than 500,000 since this formula started, and more than half of that has been in the Portland suburbs, and where the land is expensive, and we have those construction costs, and I just don't understand why there isn't room to adjust this formula to take care of this of a very fundamental, glaring problem facing this group.
Mr. Chair, if you have, in our view, the reason is that this formula is distributing on a per student basis less money than we distributed in 1901 when adjusted to inflation. And to try to switch and add the, up to the building cost, and say, if you have another $100 million outside the 5.2 to invest in buildings, that's a different issue. To rearrange the money, the operation money over this, like you said, since they started the formula, because of, we have not kept up with the rate of inflation for all the schools, all the kids. And to decide now we're also going to fund buildings out of it is a problem. And the same, it's the same problem in a sense that locally you need to do maintenance and repair, and you put it aside because you got to still serve the kid. The kids are going to be there, and you put off the building stuff. I do not recognize that the building is a very significant problem in the growth areas. It's also a significant problem in the Lebanon's and places where the buildings are falling down. And but it's a different problem than our operating problem.
Representative Williams.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ossie, if I could, I just want to, I guess you made a statement which I think is probably an accurate one in the big picture. I'm not sure it's an accurate one in the small picture, where you indicated that on a funding basis we haven't kept pace with the rate of inflation. I mean, that's true for a lot of school districts in this state who, as a result of sort of being held in neutral while we equalized, that's accurate. But, I mean, it's also accurate to say there are a number of school districts that over the last 10 years as we've moved from the formula into equalization have actually gained substantially over the rate of inflation from where they had started. Isn't that accurate?
Mr. Chair, actually, my statement had to do with the statewide average.
Right.
The state as a whole has not. I'd have to go back and look district by district. Your statement might be true. I don't think it'd be true of very many, but it might be true of some.
Well, I mean, maybe I can rephrase it again to sort of make my point, and maybe it's somewhat tangentially related to the point that Representative Haas, I think, was trying to make, which is that while this system, as we move as a result of Measure 5 and towards statewide equalization, has created significant impacts on a number of districts where they've either been, they were held in their sort of position as we waited for equity to catch up in a lot of places and weren't able and didn't get any additional money. I think we call those flat funded, which they stayed for quite some time until we achieved equity. But there were a number of districts. The number, I guess, is probably ascertainable, but there were a number of districts who actually have benefited as a result of that system. Isn't that right?
And that's correct.
Okay. That's the point, I guess, I'm trying to make.
But, Mr. Chair, Mr. Williams, I also think that if you go back and look at the rate of inflation, all districts this time around are in difficulty, whether they got boosted earlier. Districts have used up their cash reserves, et cetera. And so all districts, We've got all districts in the same spot now. And yes, some of them got more to get there, but now they're all in the same spot.
If I could, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not disagreeing. I'm not suggesting that any of them aren't in a difficult spot. I guess I was, taking a little bit of issue with the point that, well, maybe on a statewide average, we haven't kept up with the relative inflation. This system has created, over a period of time, a number of winners and some losers in the way the system's come forward. And I think one of the challenges this committee has as we try to look at this is to determine, we're in the position of having to make some other determinations that are going to create some winners and some losers in this process. And at some point, it's up to us to balance not the equity on the page, but to some degree the equity in the process.
Okay. Another response.
That's fair.
Can I put another quarter in?
Yeah.
Can I put in a dime? Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Beck.
Well, we do all often, I think everyone talks about this as winner. We don't touch this formula because there's winners and losers. There's always a presumption, this whole process for the last 10 years, that there's, no matter what we do, there's going to be winners and losers. And I guess I wish this conversation could be about how to create winners and winners. And if we can't do it through the formula, then figure out other ways to do it. I think the local option authority we granted last session was one way to do that. And maybe we need to keep looking at that and expanding that authority as a way to continue to add a little more local authority to districts that are able and want to and have the political and the civic support to do it. But this notion that we can't solve our umpteen district's problems because it comes at somebody's expense, of course that's true in this box that we talk in. But I wish we could, in the context of this formula, talk about what are the other tools out there that either are on the table or aren't on the table yet, but should be, to address the problems that some, maybe not all of us, but some of us have on this committee. Maybe the other committee doesn't have these kinds of problems. But anyway, that's more than my 10 cents. But
let's see if we get a response.
Yeah.
We're in favor of local option. We're in favor of other ways to get us more revenue. We're in favor of tax reform to get more revenue. You don't...
Fat tax?
Yeah, right. We're in favor of that. There's hardly a way to raise money we're not in favor of, but I don't think that we fundamentally solve your problem. The formula can't solve the problem. We only got a certain amount of resources. I think the formula has tested out pretty well over the decade. I think that the new data ability to generate data may create some better science to make some changes in it, but that won't get at the problem that you're raising.
Go ahead.
Well, the comment was more to the committee than Ozzie. I mean, I really just wanted to prod the committee to think creatively about some of the things we might want to put on the table to address whatever problems we all know our district's in.
Ozzie, I think it's useful to... your comments about keeping in mind that the formula is an operational, deals with operational costs primarily is worthwhile. And I guess in a no doubt unintended sort of way, but nevertheless maybe real, would you agree that Measure 5, while it shifted to the state the primary burden for funding the operations of schools, didn't it also, by artificially reducing the property tax rate for schools, make it a more favorable climate in local communities to pass bond levies and local options? I mean, if we weren't funding 70% of the operating costs and that funding was coming from local property taxes still,
right,
we would be paying substantially higher rates of property tax for operations at the local level than we are now. And it seems to me it would even be harder for local districts to pass bonds for those growth constraints.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct, but it doesn't.
I'm not saying that. No, I'm just.
That's probably true. But the districts that I was talking about, I think you've got $6 or $7 now in just facilities, I think. And I'm not sure where your bonds are. Would they be able to pass them if they were already paying 21?
Right, for operation.
It's more difficult. But it doesn't address the question of how difficult it is to get the next $2 or what.
Sure.
That, I mean, that's,
I guess just on follow-up to that, though, as I recall looking at Randall Edwards' chart that he showed us of bonds, haven't we seen the passage rate of bonds and the local options, I think, at historically high levels in the last 5 years since Measure 5 rolled in?
We've had some good, some success, yes. I don't know enough. I don't have any data to say. I don't know about history.
Who else has been here? Representative Carlson.
Thank you. I just said, just listening to the conversation and Representative Beck's comments and yours, because I was, the idea that, you know, thinking outside the box, we are sort of in a box in a sense, in my mind, that Measure 5 and the other things that have rolled out over this last decade, equalization and so on, have sort of put us in a catch-22, if you will, in many ways, in how far we can go. But as we talk about, at least in my communities, we talk about the issues of how we fund our schools, and Salem-Keizer is also a growing school district. I had lunch yesterday with Kay Baker, who's our superintendent, and I graduated from McNary High School in 1971. Our school was overcrowded in 1971. We didn't have nearly, you can figure that out, we didn't have nearly as many people in Salem then as we do now, and yet schools were crowded then. This has been a chronic problem in the Salem-Keizer district, and so some of it is the way things are managed, I think. But when you raise that discussion with folks that don't want to increase the tax base, if you will, on any side, they say, well, just lay off a few teachers or just lay off that fat administration and, you know, find efficiencies. Are there any, and because I've been kind of out of this conversation in the last several years, have you done studies or gathered data in terms of showing ratios of administration to staff and ratios of staff to students that help in that conversation about whether there are indeed more efficiencies to find in the districts themselves before the voters are willing to move forward on a solution that's maybe outside the box?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson,
there are
studies, there are lots of studies. Uh-huh. By and large, we have large class sizes or ratios compared to the rest of the world.
Uh-huh.
And by and large, on the ratio administration to other to manage or management to employees, we're high in the nation, and we just beat the tar out of what they do in the private sector. And we do not have many managers compared to the, we're way down compared to all forms, but we get told all the time that we're overmanaged and overstaffed, et cetera, and we don't have them in the classroom and all that stuff. And you can't, it's a very difficult argument to win, because even if you have numbers, people just know better.
Mm-hmm.
But I've done a lot of stuff with, because I happen to represent managers, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you compare us to the banking industry, the real estate industry, the steel industry, and there's lots of national labor data that shows that we're not overstaffed in that manner. And the same thing on the class size side. But that doesn't win you any arguments. I can make that speech at Rotary, and I still don't get votes to change the tax system.
Okay.
What else?
Well, I throw that out.
Yeah. Yeah,
this is good background discussion for getting into the bill. Is anybody else?
One thing I want to really be sure you think about before you talk, the formula is not an entitlement formula. We have entitlements from the feds, and you know what problems they create, and we don't want to change this to an entitlement formula. You've got local school boards. The formula is designed to, as equity as possible, distribute the resources, and then local communities build schools to meet their local community needs. I hope as you get into that discussion, you get pressed different ways on it, and I would sure hope you'd think about that.
Actually, before you leave the table, Ozzie and Steve, if you could look and clarify for the committee the far right column on this stimulation. We have two things happening here. One is the, as I understand, you have the 2001 ADMW. That's the number. That is the increase per student over 2001. So tell us what's going on.
Mr. Chair,
I haven't looked at this for a while. The two far right-hand columns, Senate Bill 519A, change.
Mm-hmm.
The first column is the dollars per weighted student change compared to 2000-2001.
Compared to?
Yes.
Okay.
So you have the difference between the 2000-2001 dollars per ADMW and the Senate Bill 519 dollars per ADMW columns. Okay. That difference.
I take it if you look at the, if you compare the third column from the right against the third column from the left against the third column from the right.
Correct.
Is that the difference that appears in the second column from the right?
Okay. Less $7.
Then tell us what the next one is. That's why I'm asking that.
Ms. Chair, and for the new members of the committee, the way you read these are every district that's got a minus seven, Senate Bill 519 costs those districts $7 a kid.
Right. Okay.
Right.
And
that's where I was.
Monroe School District picks up $53.
No, that's compared to current law.
The current law, right. Yeah. That's it. 519 creates those changes in law.
Right.
And the way I explain it to large group, if you're not benefiting 519, it costs you $7 a kid. If you do benefit,
this is the benefit is there.
Mr. Chair,
Williams.
Well, I just want to make sure that I understand it, because I thought I worked out the math on my own district. But if I looked at my district, if I took the...
What's your district being?
Well, if you look in, let's just use Tigard in Washington County on the last page. As I understand it, the current per ADMW amount that I would be getting under the current law without the 519 change would be $5,104 per student.
Correct.
The difference between $504 minus the $4,955, which they got in the last biennium, is actually $149, and you subtract the $7, which we would then lose as a result of the 519 change, and that leaves us with $104 per student.
$142.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, is there some confusion, I guess, in the column second to the right, you have at the top 2000-2001, and then the far right column is 2001-02.
With and without 519.
Right. Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Okay, the increase between 2001-02 and current law and this year is because we're presuming a school budget figure that's in the governor's budget?
Yeah.
But,
correct.
All right, so the 5.2 is rolled into this 01-02.
Okay. Do we have the assumptions? We don't have the standard assumptions. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there we are. Yeah, there we are. They're up in the box.
Okay. Because there's special. Okay, all right. But it's still higher.
Yeah,
okay.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, Rusty Carlson.
And then Mr.
Doesn't include the $220 million.
No.
Okay. We were just figuring that out.
I just would say, Mr. Chair, the reason for the two columns came from the Senate discussion, and there was confusion over the minus $7 from what? And the minus $7 is from what you would have gotten under current law with the governor's budget.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other column is to compare with where you are now in terms of your mm-hmm. current distribution.
Okay. So I think it's important to note that's minus seven. It's not actually a decline.
Right.
That's a difference from what you would get or would have gotten under current law.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I wanted to make sure we were clear on.
With the
point. Right. Assuming the funding level.
Minus
yeah.
210. Right.
And it's rounded, so if it doesn't exactly add up within a dollar, it's a refraction of money.
It's rounded.
Yeah. Rounded. Good. Good discussion.
Well, Chair.
Representative Beck. I want to note that committee members have already highlighted their own county.
I've highlighted the.
We are not parochial.
I've highlighted. The whole committee.
Oh, you have, okay.
And I want to report that one of my districts is the winner.
Riverdale.
Oh.
Hey!
They are very deserving. 90% private tuition paying students.
Ozzie.
Ms. Chair, Reggie Beck. I couldn't write the language. Can't write language. It just picks out somebody and excludes
you. Well, couldn't you say except for rich kids?
I try.
Anybody else wish to talk to us for 6 minutes about Senate Bill 519 or the funding formula?
No.
Okay. This will be back on Tuesday. We will pursue it further then. I want to thank everybody. We're back to a full agenda of bills. tomorrow, but for now we are...
I had a background discussion, so...
Adjourned.